again. Now, you may have read a great deal recently about William Wilberforce, the famous anti-slavery campaigner. If the BBC are to be believed, then William Wilberforce was one of the greatest people ever walked the face of the earth. For 18 years, he led the campaign for the abolition of slavery. In 1807, the slave trade was finally abolished in the British Empire. And in 1833, just before he died, all the slaves in the British Empire were finally freed. What a wonderful man. What a modern-day saint. In reality, of course, the truth is a little bit different. William Wilberforce, it turns out, was a religious fanatic who was influenced by another religious fanatic who was simply trying to stamp out and destroy a part of his identity he hated, which was that he'd been a slave trader, and he felt guilty about it. William Wilberforce himself had no care for ordinary people and was the most appalling snob who hated people that were poor, who hated people that were downtrodden, and did everything he could to destroy them in his own fanatical religious interests. Of course, this is not something that we tend to hear on the BBC. And so today, in honour of Simon Webb, who does a great deal of fascinating videos on his website, on his channel History Debunking incorrect presentations of history, I want to look into the nature of William Wilberforce. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, for those who didn't get the reference, I was channeling there Mr. Simon Webb, who is an historian who I have interviewed on The Jolly Heretic and who does a fantastic job of debunking. His channel is called History Debunked, debunking inaccurate representations of history, debunking historical myths. Now, one historical myth which I don't think he's looked at, and which perhaps I think he should look at, is the historical mythology surrounding William Wilberforce. We are all told that William Wilberforce was this fantastic guy, this passionate man, this kind, caring man, who this lover of the downtrodden, who dedicated his career to freeing the slaves because he was just such a kind man who was so focused on those who were disempowered. A modern hero. This is absolute balderdash. William Wilberforce was a fanatical evangelical Christian of the most extreme conservative kind, whose evangelical Christianity allowed him to cope with the guilt that he might feel about being wealthy and rich by telling him that this was God's will. It allowed him to cope with the guilt that he might feel about having all this power and money and whatever while other people were struggling in destitution by believing that the entire social system was God's will. And as such, anybody that questioned the religion was a clear and present danger to him because they questioned the thing which allowed him to cope with his own feelings of guilt or his own feelings that he was a bit of a fraud and it wasn't quite, life wasn't as it should be. So anyone that questioned religiosity had to be persecuted. And of course, anybody that tried to bring about the liberation of working class people or the empowerment of working class people had to be persecuted because they were a danger to him and they were a danger to his feelings of sort of superiority and so on. And the reason why he was opposed to slavery, which would seem contradictory to being such an extreme religious conservative, was that he came under the influence of someone who was a former slave trader who had a religious experience and therefore persecuted the concept of trading slaves. Because this is what often happens if you have a religious experience. You have a fundamental change of self and you regard your old self as fundamentally evil, and if you see your old self in other people then you hate it and you despise it and it reminds you of what you used to be, and so you try and stamp it out. And Wilberforce came under the hypnotic religious influence, as did a number of other prominent figures, of this man, and therefore he was opposed to slavery. So let's have a look at this. In according to the BBC website, as I said earlier, in my Simon Webb mode, for 18 years of his life, William Wilberforce led the campaign for the abolition of slavery. In 1807, the slave trade was abolished in the British Empire. That did not mean, by the way, that slaves were freed. And in fact, Wilberforce opposed the freedom of people that were already slaves, arguing that they wouldn't be able to cope with freedom. And so it wasn't until 1833, which was the year that Wilberforce died, that the slaves who were already slaves were actually freed in the British Empire. Now, as I say, this man was a religious fanatic, and he was brainwashed by another religious fanatic who was particularly anti-slavery. Let's have a look at his background. William Wilberforce was born in 1759 to a family of extremely wealthy merchants in Hull in Yorkshire. That family, by the way, were wealthy merchants because of their relationship to the slave trade. On one side of his family, they had sugar plantations and so on. So one of the reasons why they were extremely wealthy was because of their use of slaves, of their interaction with the slave trade. But that's not saying that much, in so much as that was the case of many extremely wealthy British families at the time. He goes to Hull Grammar School. At that time, the public schools hadn't yet completely taken over the upper class, so he goes to Hull Grammar School, and then he goes to school in Putney. In Putney, you see the stirrings of religiousness. He has minor religious experiences, and he starts to become what's called the word they use, enthusiasm. So a person that's very religiously fervent and charismatic in their worship. This is considered a bit of a problem, so he's taken back to Hull Grammar School, finishes there, goes to Cambridge. Now, at Cambridge, he was incredibly involved in hedonism. He was an extreme hedonist in the drinking, in probably the whoring, in the partying, in whatever, of Cambridge University undergraduate life at the time. He was the ultimate hedonist. At Cambridge, he also became very good friends with William Pitt, who was later at the age of 24 to become Prime Minister. And while he was still at Cambridge at the age of 21, his rich family bought him a rotten borough they had at the time. The whole system was completely corrupt. Very few people could vote, and you would bribe your way into Parliament. He spent £8,000 bribing the various voters that lived in this, the various electors that lived in this particular borough to become their MP, and so he was sent into Parliament in 1781, when he was 21 years old. And then a few years later, his good friend William Pitt in 1783, William Pitt the Younger, becomes Prime Minister. So we're dealing with this incredibly, extremely hedonistic person who has stirrings of religiosity. Now, what's that about? Well, in psychological terms, that kind of religiosity is what William James, the American psychologist, would call the religion of the sick soul. So you get people that are just religious all the time, and they have a general sense of religiosity, a general sense that the world is a good place, a general sense that they are content and that they are good and that God is looking after them, and they occasionally have kind of religious experiences at times of elevated stress or whatever, and then they feel better, and that's how they live their lives. Then you have the religion of the sick soul. This is a person that is very high in neuroticism, that is very mentally unstable, that feels negative feelings like shame and anger and whatever very, very strongly. And those kinds of people will tend to go through periods of intense unhappiness, of intense and profound despair, at times of change. And these will be followed by intense religious experiences, because what happens when you're disposed is the level of stress becomes so high that the body can't cope with this. We have two fundamental systems in our body, arousal and quiescence, or calming. And when the level of arousal, which is caused by stress, becomes so high, it's dangerous. The body reacts to this through quiescence, i.e. through calming the person down. Now, in this context of hyperarousal, we are very, very in touch with our instincts. And one of our instincts is to believe in God. So when the more stressed we become, the higher is our mortality salience and our feelings of exclusion, then the more likely we are to believe in God, and the more likely we are to over-detect agency, because this is something we're also evolved to do, because in prehistory, if you heard a noise in the distance and you thought it was a wolf and it was a stick or something, then you've lost nothing. But if you think it's a stick and it turns out to be a wolf, then you could be killed. So we select to over-detect agency. So in that context, then, you that hyper-aroused context, you might hear a sound and you interpret it as God's voice or something like that. When that happens, then the quiescence comes in, the positive feelings come flooding through, and you have this religious experience. And this can help you to cope and reduce your negative feelings for a period of time. And you go through a period of extreme religious fervour. That is the religion of the sick soul. And there is evidence that in his mid-teens, that is something like that happened to William Wilberforce, and therefore his family took him away from Putney, where he was being educated, and back to Yorkshire, where they could control him. And it seems that something like this happened to William Wilberforce in 1784. He travelled abroad, he travelled to France on this extended holiday. This was eye-opening for him and whatever, and stressful for him, and made him think about life and think about himself. And this kind of religious experience, this conversion took place. Now, once the conversion takes place, what you could also get is a fundamental change in the nature of identity. People that are highly neurotic and feel negative feelings strongly, if they see the world as a fearful, dangerous place, it doesn't make any sense, and they don't quite know who they are. And so one of the ways that they will deal with this is by adopting a clear identity, that's who they are, that's me, this is me. They don't really feel that that's them. They don't really feel secure in this identity. They're always questioning it. But they will adopt this sort of semi-fake sense of identity. And in the case of Wilberforce, that identity was as a hedonist, was as a Whig, was as a bit of a leftist, whatever, as a sort of debonair, sort of extravagant chap. Now, he has the religious experience, and then, of course, that involves questioning the sense of identity. He doesn't know who he is anymore. He needs a new identity, and the religious experience brings him towards a new identity, which is the opposite of the old identity, an extremely religious person. This is what makes me the best. This is what makes me important. This is what makes me good. This is what makes me a sense of my life in a way that the other thing didn't, because I've now doubted it. I am the most religious person that there could possibly be. Now, in this context, of course, you then start to get a sort of runaway religiousness. This is a highly religious conservative society, and so the way that you would gain status is to be more religious than the last man, more conservative than the last man. So he becomes highly puritanical. I'm sorry, I have to blow my nose. He becomes highly puritanical. He becomes loathing of everything that he used to be. He was by all accounts a jolly and witty person, one of the best speakers in the House of Commons, but he was this highly puritanical, extremely religious person. And what the new evangelical religiosity that he'd adopted was, it was of a very specific kind. It was a religiosity that said that the most important thing in the world, and that makes sense of the world, that gives us order and structure, is Christianity. Anything that questions Christianity is therefore dangerous, because Christianity upholds the social order. Anything that questions Christianity has to be stamped out. Anything that questions Christianity, i.e. the old hymn, is evil and wicked. Because that's the old him. He sees in people that question Christianity the old him that was unhappy, the old him that he doesn't like, the old him that he despises. It makes him realise that that life isn't as clear cut as he likes to think it is. And so this upsets him, and this triggers him. This creates cognitive dissonance, of course, that there are people that doubt his Christianity. His Christianity is the thing that makes him important. It's the thing that makes him content. It's the thing that makes him cope with life. So for people to question Christianity is to question the thing which allows him to cope. And if that thing that allows him to cope is taken away, then it's just despair. So that can't be allowed to happen. So therefore, anyone that questions the thing that allows him to cope has to be shut out and destroyed, so that he can carry on with his sense that life makes sense, and that he is superior, and that he is wonderful. So he's utterly against, fanatically against anyone that questions Christianity. That's the first thing, because you can see Christianity for him as a kind of false self that maybe he doesn't really feel deep down. And so but the false self allows him to cope with life. And so if you do something which questions the veracity of the false self, then it highlights the fact that it's false. It highlights that deep down he knows it's false, and his deep feelings of insecurity. And therefore all those feelings of insecurity come up. How do you cope with this cognitive dissonance? You make the thing that's causing you to feel insecure go away, so you don't have to think about it anymore. So that's the first thing, that he was anything against Christianity was a problem. But secondly, it seems that the Christianity that he adopted was perhaps a way of dealing with guilt about being rich. It was a Christianity that rendered the social system the will of God. It is God's will that there be this deeply unequal, unfair social system with the rich at the top and the very poor destitute at the bottom. And so anyone that would question this was also dangerous, because by questioning this, they are questioning something which is allowing him to cope, which is that this whole system is God's will and that God has chosen that he should be in this high position. And if that's not the case, well, then he's just a depraved, unpleasant man who's selfish and has lots of money. So you can't have people questioning the social system either. And if you look at the way he voted in the House of Commons, he voted in 1794 to suspend habeas corpus because the upper class were so frightened of the French Revolution. This allowed you to just arrest anybody that the government didn't like. He voted to ban various academic societies on the grounds that they supposedly espoused atheism, it being a criminal offence to espouse atheism. He voted in favour of the Blasphemy Act of 1819, which made it a serious criminal offence to question Christian doctrines in any way. He backed in 1794 the prosecution of the London Correspondence Society for treason, simply because the London Correspondence Society argued that there should be an extension to the vote, argued that there should be universal suffrage in England for males. So they were therefore prosecuted for treason for arguing that. In the end, they weren't found guilty, but a number of their members were, because habeas corpus was suspended, were put in prison for 2 years without trial, just for arguing. And he was in favour of this, for putting people in prison without trial, simply for saying that there should be an extension to the vote. He argued that Christianity renders the people that are low down the social scale, it renders their appalling lives, in his words, less galling for the lower orders. And it makes them humble, and it makes them, you know, content with their place in life. So for him, Christianity was crucially important. Anyone that questioned it was questioning the system that allowed him to be rich, and therefore and allowed him to not feel a sense of guilt about being rich, because it was God's will, and therefore was extremely dangerous and needed to be stamped out. And indeed, they were. He was a leading part of a group called the Society for the Suppression of Vice, in which they would campaign for the prosecution of people who published or who sold books which they regarded as blasphemous. There was a particular case of a bookseller in London called Williams, who sold one copy of The Age of Reason by Thomas Paine, and he was prosecuted. And it came to the attention of the barrister, the prosecuting barrister, that the result of this was that his family were living in destitution, he was in prison, seriously ill, his family was seriously ill, they were in utter impoverishment, and they went to the society and asked them to sort of drop the prosecution, and they absolutely wouldn't. So they were prepared to let this person and his family die simply because he had sold one copy of The Age of Reason by Thomas Paine. And it should be emphasised that William Wilberforce was a leading member of this society who would have been highly influential in their decisions. So Wilberforce was prepared to let a family die in destitution on the grounds that the head of that family had sold one copy in his bookshop of The Age of Reason. That is how fanatical he was. And he also voted, of course, for the banning of trade unions as dangerous to society. So what we then have with William Wilberforce is a religious fanatic whose religious fanaticism involves, one, stamping out the former self, who was extremely hedonistic and atheistic and whatever, and destroying anything which reminds him of that former self, because that reminds him of his own insecurities about his own identity, and that in turn makes him feel a sense of despair, and so that has to be stopped. So that's the first thing we have with William Wilberforce. And secondly, a person who's extraordinarily wealthy and may have some sense of guilt about this and deals with this by developing a religiosity which makes total inequality the will of God, and therefore anyone that questions that religiosity, it's again making him think that maybe he's not the person he thinks he is, maybe he's not the important person he thinks he is, maybe he's just nothing and scum. So this triggers him, and they have to be stamped out. One could see it perhaps as borderline personality, or indeed as what one might call insecure narcissism, as vulnerable narcissism. Now, where does the attitude towards slavery come from? Isn't it a bit contradictory to have this highly conservative form of religiosity, but at the same time, where you're in, totally in favour of power, but at the same time to campaign against the slave trade? How did this happen? It doesn't seem to be, because he didn't talk about this, about any guilt about his own family's slight involvement in the slave trade. No, it's something else. So people that are highly religious like this, but that are deeply insecure, can come under the power of highly charismatic religious leaders who are, in a sense, even more extreme in their religion of the sick soul than someone like Wilberforce. Wilberforce, in many ways, is a religious follower, and there is a religious leader under whose spellbinding charisma he came. And that was a person called the Reverend John Newton, who lived from 1725 to 1807. Newton was a captain on slave ships. Newton was a slaver who went out and traded for slaves with many kings in Sierra Leone and Benin and places like this, and brought slaves back to England. He was heavily involved in the triangle of trade. In 1745, due to some sort of disagreement, he was enslaved himself by a queen in Sierra Leone, but he managed to be rescued, and he continued as being a captain on slave ships and all of this sort of thing. So he was heavily involved in the slave trade. It tells you about his personality that then at some point he has a conversion to Christianity. He is ordained an Anglican vicar. And then he becomes rabidly opposed to the slave trade. And he spends his career campaigning against the slave trade, saying it's anti-Christian and it's evil and it's the worst thing possible. Now, this, even more than is the case with Wilberforce, is an example of the religion of the sick soul, is an example of the zeal of the convert, is an example of prey into hunter, the idea that if you have some sort of borderline personality, which can result, as I say, from extreme neuroticism, then you will flip to exactly the opposite personality, to exactly the opposite sense of self. And you will hate the old sense of self, because the very fact that you used to be a different self to the self that you are reminds you that you don't really know who you are, reminds you that you don't really feel this new self, reminds you that ultimately there is this despair and this sense of nothingness that you're trying to cover up by having an extreme self, and therefore it's just horrific for you, it's horrible for you, and so therefore whenever you see it, whenever you see your old self, you hate it and you want to stamp it out. And this is known, as I say, prey into hunter, that it is well known that those that have a conversion like this will hate everything about their old self, because it will remind them of a terrible time in their lives that led up to the conversion. And also, of course, it will remind them that even their new self is hollow and they're not really sure about who they are. And this needs to be suppressed. This needs to be pushed down. And so you do this by persecuting the old self. You see this with St. Paul. He started off as the arch persecutor of Christians, and then he has a conversion on the road to Damascus and he becomes the arch Christian. So you see that, who then persecute, kind of non-Christians. And so you see this with John Newton, rabidly against the slave trade. By the way, he also wrote the song Amazing Grace. William Wilberforce came under the influence of John Newton in his evangelical phase. And it was John Newton that persuaded him, therefore, that or planted in him the seed of the idea that slavery was a bad thing and should be opposed for Christian reasons. Even if it contradicted the broader conservative theology which Wilberforce had adopted. Consistency, not so important to these people. What's important is feeling good. What's important, and what made, presumably, Wilberforce feel good was following this leader and making this leader, this charismatic, feel pleased with him and so on. And so that is why, or partly why, Wilberforce adopted this policy of being against slavery. In addition, I think he may have come under the charisma, and he would have been charismatic, of William Pitt, and who was, so brilliant that he became Prime Minister at the age of 24. And William Pitt had highlighted certain problems with slavery. What was happening in the British Empire was that Jamaica and the British colonies were becoming exhausted, whereas Haiti, that the French held, that was fantastic, and they were pretty with their slave colony, and they were producing loads of sugar and whatever, and they were able to sell their sugar, therefore, for far less than the British were able to sell their sugar for, and so it was becoming, that was a serious problem for the British Empire. So how could you undermine the French? How could you deal with this problem? Well, one way is you could abolish slavery. If you could get rid of slavery, if you could suppress slavery across the world, if the British Navy could be sent in to stop the slave routes, which is what happened, then, of course, this would mess up the French and we would be doing better competitively. So it could be argued that that was the motivation for getting rid of slavery, and Wilberforce was simply the useful patsy who this other charismatic figure was brought in to campaign to abolish slavery. So it could be argued that William Wilberforce, he comes across as a sort of a leader of men who pioneers the abolition of slavery. No, I don't think that's the case. I think he was a kind of beta male. He was a follower who was insecure in himself and was looking for people to lead him. And he found two people that would lead him. William Pitt, his friend from his days at Cambridge University, who was Prime Minister, and, of course, John Newton. And both of those people, for their own separate reasons, were unhappy about the slave system. And they used Wilberforce with his undoubted wit and, you know, brilliant speaking and whatever, a kind of Winston Churchill type, a neurotic person who was a fantastic public speaker and a general bon vivant, to lead the campaign for the abolition of slavery, which they managed to do. So the idea that William Wilberforce should be seen as some sort of modern hero is nonsense. William Wilberforce was a fundamentalist, conservative, religious fanatic who coped with his own feelings of insecurity by creating a sort of narcissistic false self of him as the perfect Christian man. He opposed anything which reminded him of the old self, because this would, of course, remind him that actually this self was a false way of coping with life. So therefore, he opposed anybody that was anti-Christianity and that was hedonistic. And he opposed anybody which questioned the way which this new self made sense of life, which was that everything was just God's will. The whole social system was God's will. So therefore, he was profoundly conservative, and he came under the influence of these two spellbinding charismatics. And that's why he went about abolishing slavery. That is the kind of person we're dealing with, not some great man at all. Well, I hope this has been of interest. If it has, please subscribe. It really helps if you do that. Please remember our live show Mondays and Fridays. It's Thursdays, 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. If you want to help the show, you can see ways to do so below. And I will see you soon. And goodbye.